So I'm doing this year-long course on what's called the paramis, or the perfections, the paramitas. And there's 10 of them. And these are considered very important qualities of character, qualities of personal inner strength that can support Dharma practice, Buddhist practice. They have a mythological origin in that there's a myth that the man who became the Buddha spent many, many lifetimes developing himself so that he could develop those perfections, those qualities of beings that it would take to become a Buddha. And there are stories about, they're called, kind of like, some of them are like Aesop fables, various stories about how he developed himself over the many, many lifetimes that he practiced. And some of these stories have to do with, many of them have to do with the development of these 10 qualities called the 10 perfections or the 10 paramis. And as the Buddhist tradition developed, and especially in Southeast Asia, these 10 qualities were also understood to be very supportive of anybody who wanted to practice the Buddhist practice. People who are not set on becoming a Buddha don't have to develop them to the level of perfection that a Buddha does, but still they're very important qualities. And you find in Asia sometimes when people reach a wall in the practice, they're practicing and practicing and the meditation practice is going along, and so, and then they reach a wall or a plateau and they don't seem to go any further. Sometimes teachers will say, oh, now it's time for you to develop your character or develop these personal qualities. And once those qualities of character are present, then perhaps you can begin again and go further with your meditation practice, with your spiritual practice. So these 10 qualities are, the first one is generosity. The second is integrity. The third is renunciation or letting go. The fourth is wisdom. And the fifth is vigor or effort or energy. And then after that comes patience, which is the theme for this month. And then after patience comes truth, or truthfulness, dedication to truth, being honest. And then comes determination or resolve, having a strong resolve for what you want to do. And then comes loving kindness, and then equanimity. That's a list of 10 in the Theravadin tradition. And some of these are developed naturally or as a byproduct of dedicated mindfulness practice. It's as if you try to be mindful, which is another way of saying being honest, really honest, show up, be present, and really honest with what's happening here, and learn to do that in a way that's non-reactive, that a lot of these, that simple practice, maybe it's not that simple, but that practice is a magnet for developing other personal qualities or developing your character. And some people prefer not to do anything about developing their character aside from just developing the mindfulness practice, showing up, being present, being here. Some people find it's very useful to develop themselves, develop their character, because as they become more developed, it becomes much more supportive to do the mindfulness practice. So, for example, integrity is maybe more obvious one, that if a person lacks personal integrity, it's actually very hard to go very deep or very far in meditation practice, because the two are diametrically opposed to each other. If you want to practice a practice which focuses on being honest, you've got to be honest. And if you don't have that integrity, those two clash, and one is going to win out. So if you cultivate your integrity, you develop it, and think it's an important quality to have, then that becomes a soil or a bed or a foundation in which meditation practice can advance a lot easier and sometimes a lot faster. The tradition says the same thing about generosity. If you develop the ability to give and have a generous heart, it turns out it's a lot easier to develop a mindfulness practice, develop concentration and mindfulness. If you develop your capacity to let go appropriately, that also helps develop meditation practice. Now, patience, the theme for this month, is one of those things which is, for many people, the first lesson they have to learn if they begin a meditation practice. And for some people, it's also the last lesson. I think most people, when they sit down to meditate, will have to cultivate a certain degree of patience with the speed of the practice and with what they have to encounter in themselves or in their environment when they sit down to try to be still, quiet, relaxed, and calm. And if you don't develop patience, if that's not a quality you somehow come upon, you're probably going to suffer. Because if you don't develop some kind of patience, some kind of broad acceptance or broad spaciousness around some of the things that you discover about yourself in your practice, then your expectations, your agendas, your demands, your ideals, your impatience, your aversions, your fears will get the upper hand. And if they get the upper hand, then you get swept away by them. You get caught by them. You get entangled in their web, in their sticky webs. One of the ways that I developed patience through my Buddhist practice was when I practiced Zen practice in my early years of meditation practice. And in doing Zen practice, I wasn't told to do much. It was part of the beauty and sometimes the irritation of Zen practice. And you're not told anything. Except show up and be there, be present for what's there. And the way I understood that was to practice uncompromising acceptance of what was present now. And as I did that, I found that often there was impulses inside of me that didn't want to be present, wanted to be in the future, in the past, or wanted to kind of react to what was there. It wasn't accepting what's there, but was reactive, pushing it away, or wanting to hold on to certain things. But the Zen training was a training of complete acceptance of what is here. One way that translated in doing Zen meditation was physically and mentally to sit still with whatever arose, whatever was there. So an impulse would arise to itch. Now, here in our tradition, we don't say anything about that, so not so uncommon to see people itch themselves, scratch themselves. But not in Zen. You know, you have to sit still. And if you have an itch, you can't move. So you can't move your body. So that's the ground rule. You sit there with your itch. You know, the Zen of, you can write a book, The Zen of Itching. You know, attaining oneness with your itch. And so you sit there with your itch. But then you notice that your mind moves. Even though you keep your body still, the mind moves. And so the mind is irritated, the mind is angry, is impatient, the mind begins thinking about this must be skin cancer. The mind starts being afraid, the mind starts getting agitated and spinning out, and it can get quite wild in the mind if you don't get to scratch that itch. To my knowledge, no one has ever died in meditation from an itch. So it's a relatively safe phenomenon to sit still with. And so the mind moves. But the Zazen practice I did was, in a sense, not to let the mind move, or not to pick up the movements of the mind, not to get involved in them. So it's as if there's some capacity of the mind to have an impulse and to leave it alone. So it's like the container of the mind stays still, even though there's popcorn happening inside of it. Or another very different kind of approach analogy would be that it's like you have a very calm center, and you don't leave that calm center even though around the center there's agitation in the mind. So you learn just stay there. You don't pick something up. You don't go towards something. You don't go away from something. And so in Zen practice, that sitting still physically and mentally with all the mental and physical stuff that might happen, day after day after day, month after month, year after year, develops patience, develops the capacity not to pick up, not to get involved in the reactions of the mind. And that's my definition of patience this week, at least. the ability to not get caught by the reactive impulses of the mind. And there's a wide range of them. There's the reactive impulses to wonderful things happening. Someone comes along and praises you. To have patience is to not get caught or get aroused or get excited or get carried away. Don't let it go to your head by that praise. If someone criticizes you, that ability to be patient is the ability not to get caught up in the web of thoughts or reactions that might appear when you're being criticized. Oh, maybe you don't like it, maybe you're afraid with the criticism, but the fear arises and there's a place of stillness, a place in the mind that doesn't move for or against that. Unless you think an unmoving mind is a boring mind, it's one of the most beautiful things in the human psyche, is that place where the mind doesn't move. It's luminous, it's all-encompassing, it's soft, it's beautiful, beautiful thing. So the word for patience is kanti in Pali. In Sanskrit, it's kshanti. And the way that it often works when you translate between different languages, there's often not a one-to-one correspondence between English and these Indian words. And that's the case with kanti. And patience is the most common translation, but it misses a lot. And perhaps we can understand patience to have different aspects or different ways that patience manifests itself. In different circumstances, patience takes different forms. And so sometimes it's appropriate to translate this word other ways besides patience. One of the meanings of patience, of kanti, is perseverance. And that is when you're doing something that's worthwhile doing. This kanti, this patience, this perseverance, is not giving up, not getting, you can get discouraged. That can be a reaction of the mind. You can't necessarily prevent your mind from getting discouraged. But you can, with patience or this perseverance, you don't pick up the discouragement. You don't get entangled with it. You don't get caught by it. So the story I've often told of when I was writing my dissertation, I think most people, when they write dissertation, sooner or later are visited by discouragement, by this is impossible. Why did I do this? I can't do this. It's kind of the nature of dissertation. Anybody done a dissertation? Anybody not had that and done a dissertation? But because of, I attributed to my Buddhist practice that when I was, you know, plugging away and had those kinds of thoughts, I treated them like pesky little flies flying around the back of my head, kind of, and I just ignored them. I can't do this. This is impossible. It's going to take too long. And I just would focus my attention on doing the next footnote, whatever we know, the next word, the next sentence. And so so patience had the form of perseverance, where I didn't get entangled in those impulses that would distract me from continuing the direction I was going. Another form of patience is endurance. And sometimes it's translated as forbearance, endurance. And in Asian Buddhism, the forbearance or endurance is considered a very important quality. Here in the West, we talk a lot about loving kindness as being very important. And sometimes I get the sense that in Asia, they actually put forbearance or endurance at they talk about it more than they talk about loving kindness. We almost never talk about it here in the West. But endurance has the meaning, I mean, some people, the idea of endurance, even patience itself, but endurance often has kind of negative connotations. And patience can have that. It's kind of like being passive. It's maybe being kind of accepting things which shouldn't be accepted. Or it's kind of putting a limitation on us. And we don't want to be limited. And endurance can have that feeling also. But the most common example given for endurance is endurance under insult. If someone insults you. And this is something that school children try to teach each other or try to tease each other with. You know, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never touch me. And usually it's done a little bit tauntingly, right? I think. But they're trying to learn, the insult doesn't have to affect me. And I can endure it without getting caught, either with my reactions, or I can endure it without having reactions arise at all. So to endure insult. Why would a person want to endure insult? Or why would a person want to endure certain kinds of challenges or difficulties that might arise? Today, well, maybe this is not a good example, so I'll maybe bring it up back later, but one of the reasons I think is very interesting, and that is that one of the most precious treasures or resources that any individual has is their own integrity, or is their own peace of mind. And why sacrifice that because you've been insulted? The Buddha said that if you paraphrase him, if you sacrifice your peace of mind, you sacrifice your own integrity by getting angry at the person who's insulted you or insulting back, you're doing your enemy a favor, and you're doing a harm to yourself that your enemy can never do directly. And so you're actually doing them a favor because you kind of picked it up and you've kind of lashed back, and that you don't have to lash back. You can endure or stay peaceful or stay kind of more non-reactive, stay spacious about what's happening, what's going on. It might be helpful to see that the Buddha came from a particular caste in India. There were various caste societies, so people belonged to different castes. And he came from a warrior class, warrior caste. And in warriors, especially someone who has some nobility, like the Buddha was a son of a prince or a king, sometimes put a lot of value, in traditional culture at least, a lot of value on their honor, on their integrity, on their purity of heart, on their the cleanness of their intentions and behavior. And it's something, that reputation is something that sometimes classic knights and samurais in different places put so much value on that they'll sacrifice their life in order to maintain that honor. So I think that for the Buddha, there was something tremendously precious about personal integrity that had so much higher value than the value we might get back from lashing out in anger or lashing out in insult to other people, even if it might seem we have good cause, or even if in the short term it might seem like a good idea. Because if I could just lash out at that guy, he'll just leave me alone finally. So it really works. I lashed out at him, he left me alone, and it worked. Isn't that great? Proof that it works, proof that it was right. Maybe it was right in this kind of funny way, but it's right at a tremendous cost to yourself. And maybe there's a different way of getting what you need besides lashing out. So last night we had a parents' discussion group here. And there was a great story of one of the parents here who has three children. Two of them are, one's in college and one's maybe almost in college and one's 8 years old. And she said that all three of her children had trouble at school with bullying, being bullied. And the older ones, they tried to figure out what to do about it, and the school administrators didn't seem to help much. And she, I guess she never was really satisfied how they handled it with the two older ones. But with the younger one, the eight-year-old, when he was being bullied by this particular kid at school, what she figured out to do was she invited that bully home to her house for a special meal and then took this kid out to some special event with her family. And the bullying stopped. And not only that, but her son and this kid became best friends. So someone could have lashed out at that boy, the bully. Someone could have gotten the paddle and paddled him really well. And he probably never would have bullied again. But is that good? Is that useful? Just to get them to stop their behavior? I don't think that's good. I know a father who kind of said once, when my son was 3 or 4 years old, only once did I ever spank him. And from that time on, we never had any problems with him. Now, was that good? Did that straighten out the kid once and for all? And he was, you know, or was the kid so afraid or so intimidated that some life force in him was held in check from that, you know, that experience? I don't know. So what is being sacrificed? What's lost? What opportunities are lost? What potential of our own is lost when we get swept up in our reactive behavior? And it's patience or endurance or perseverance is one of those qualities, very important qualities, that it preserves or helps us not to get caught up by our reactivity. It's really an essential quality, I think, for civilized human life, for sane, kind, productive human life, is to have that. And I suspect everyone who's alive has some degree of patience. It can take effort. Sometimes it's the effort of perseverance, hanging in there, making the effort, just continuing. And meditation practice requires a lot of perseverance. Sometimes meditation practice is not good news. You know, self-knowledge is seldom good news, they say. So in mindfulness practice, where you're seeing yourself. Or sometimes things don't go according to plan in meditation. So often, in fact, that good meditators usually give up planning for their meditation. You know, but people who don't have enough experience, they're trying. Okay, am I concentrated yet? You know, it's not happening. It's best not to, you know, be on some kind of timeline. The spiritual life, the inner life, the spiritual life of the psyche, really has its own time. I think it has a rhyme and reason to that time, but it's not usually the time that is the agenda of our small mind, or the time frame of our society, which is ever going faster and faster. And there's a story once of the Dalai Lama giving teaching to a big audience of people. And I believe he was talking about the Bodhisattva path. And someone asked him a question in the hall and asked him what the fastest way was to becoming enlightened or becoming a Buddha. And as the story has been told to me, the Dalai Lama stopped for a long time, just was really silent. And then apparently tears went down his cheek. And then at some point he said something about how sad it was, this drive, this ambition, this greed to get results as fast as possible. I think the inner, the heart is shy, the heart is slow. It's this is a nice story also. I know someone, I don't know who it is anymore, but some story about someone who said, every day I meditate for half an hour. When I'm really busy, I meditate for an hour. The last meaning of kanti or kshanti is forgiveness. So it's kind of interesting that the word for patience and forgiveness are kind of conflated in this one word, akshanti, kanti. And one of the meanings of forgiveness is simply to not hold a grudge, not hold resentment, not be a person who is unsafe for another person. If you're holding resentment, you're kind of unsafe for that other person. I like that very simple definition because it's a lower bar to cross than to say forgiveness is to open your heart and welcome them back into your home or to welcome them lovingly. You know, I love you and everything's forgiven. To say, no, you know, I'm not going to harm you anymore. I'm not going to hold a grudge against you. That's a lower bar, I think. The Buddhist tradition does put a lot of emphasis on developing loving kindness. But I see it as two different steps. And if the two steps are tied together, letting go of a resentment and loving, it's maybe kind of too much to handle all at once. But if we can simply focus on letting go of our resentment, because if there is no resentment, there's no need for forgiveness. So if we can let go of our resentment, then, you know, that's the first step. And then later we can work on opening our hearts to them or having the love for them. So there are lots of opportunities for cultivating patience, for cultivating perseverance or endurance or forbearance or forgiveness. I was here meditating peacefully, happily at the center until 4:30. And between 4:30 and coming back here, I actually came late, 7:40 or something. I was surprised how many occasions for patience I had. Normally I wouldn't have thought about it. It was patience that I was doing. I was practicing patience, but because I was going to talk about it, oh yeah, that's patience operating. And they could go from here home, because at 5 o'clock my son had Little League practice. So I got there on time, but it took a while to realize we were in the wrong field, the wrong park. Mostly they meet in one place, but once in a while they meet someplace else. I hadn't been told. It was a good thing because there was another parent there. So I was, oh, good, so I could help her. She didn't know, so I could tell her, oh, we have to go to the other place. But the other place was on the other side of Redwood City. And at 5 o'clock, the traffic in El Camino. And I could feel myself starting to get a little bit impatient for getting there and a little bit irritated. And I did a little bit of reflection. I said, you know, why in the world is this worth getting irritated about? For what reason? I was trying to go through the list of reasons. Why should I get irritated at this? Because someone told me to go to the wrong field? I hold a grudge? That didn't make any sense. Because it was, you know, life-threatening to my son if he didn't get there on time to Little League? You know, it was really he was really relaxed. He didn't seem to care. He was happy to go, but it was just, this is what was happening. Life was happening this way, and he didn't seem to, you know, he just was going along with the flow. So he was okay with it. The coaches, you know, was I concerned about the coaches and what they would think? You know, I went through all the reasons I could think about, and none of them held any water. None of them had, you know, didn't make any sense. I think that if I hadn't done that reflection, some of those voices would have operated kind of in the background, and I wouldn't have questioned them. But I took the time. I was very curious. What are the reasons? And I couldn't find any. And why would I bother to get impatient around this? And in fact, nothing dire was going to happen. Nothing wrong was going to happen. Everything was cool and fine as far as I could tell. There was no reason to pick up getting late for Little League practice as a cause of sacrificing my peace. In all these perfections, including patience, are seen as being strengths. And as they develop as strengths, they can be, it'd be appropriate to call them powers. They become personal powers that we carry with us. So there can be a power of patience. So not to think again that patience is something passive or something like an absence of something. It can be a very powerful form of inner strength that we carry with us into different situations. And I had a little bit extra strength in that department this afternoon because I'd spent a little bit of time this afternoon meditating here. A little bit calmer, more centered, or had a little more ability to stay present and to question what was going on and look at it. So certainly meditating or being careful with how we live our life so we don't get, you know, we meditate a little bit or do something that calms us or relaxes us or creates some space in the mind is very helpful. Another step that's helpful for developing patience is reframing the situation. So it's one thing to question the authority of how we are framing it, but another way is to reframe the situation in different ways. And one of the ones, it's somewhat classic in Buddhism, is sometimes formulated with the idea, see everybody in the world except for one person is a Buddha, is fully enlightened. And they're all here to teach that one person who's not. And who's that one person? You. So no matter what the circumstances are happening, they're there to teach you something. And there's a story, a famous story of Gurdjieff having a little ashram or colony or kind of community outside of Paris, and spiritual community. And there was a really difficult person who lived there. And everyone else in the community didn't like him. And they made it kind of hard for him to be there, apparently. And so one day, he left. He packed up and left. So Gurdjieff went to Paris and found him and said, "Can you please come back? Well, no one wants me there. No one likes me there. Oh, please come back. I'll pay you to come back." "Okay, I'll come back." And so he came back. And then everyone looked at Gurdjieff. "What? We finally got rid of this difficult person." And Gurdjieff said, "You need him. Because you need someone. If everything's smooth and easy, you're not developing, you're not being challenged. So to see even difficult people as your teachers." So in the Theravada tradition, this reframing is said this way. A difficult person is a benefactor, for he or she is the basis for developing patience. If there were no wrongdoers, how could I accomplish the perfection of patience? So, look for those opportunities. I mean, don't go too far out of the way. When they come looking for you, then use those opportunities. See what it takes. Understand yourself. And if you simply understand, oh, this is an opportunity to develop myself, to cultivate myself, to discover where is my integrity, to look at the authority of your beliefs, look at the authority of the ways you've understood the situation, to look at how you relate to your impulses, your reactions, your feelings. And use the opportunity, use the opportunity to have some strength, some power of staying still, not moving. If you have very strong impulses, like if you're an addict, and Buddhism says everybody's an addict, you know, we're all recovering humans. Because, you know, if we're not addicted to substances, we're addicted to our thoughts or to our ego. But if you find a very strong impulse, say you have an addiction like cigarettes or alcohol or food or something, or you have a very strong impulse towards being angry, some very strong impulses rises in you. Look for one. Look for one to arise. Don't make one happen. Don't manufacture it. But look for the opportunity when a really strong thing happens. And if you have a partner or a good friend, you can, if you dare, you can enlist their help, and they can say, "This is the time," you know. So now is when you should do this practice that Gill recommends. And the practice is, wait it out. Ride it out. Ride out the wave. Or wait it out. So you feel this tremendous urge, and you know, with addiction, it can be extremely compelling. All the lawyers in the mind come out and give all the reasons. And all this very strong sense, compelling feelings in the body can arise. So compelling, the feeling. Like the physical feelings can have so much authority that how could you, anybody in the right mind not listen to it? Wait it out. Don't act on it. Stay still. Find a nice chair and just don't move. And wait it out until you find yourself on the backside of the wave. When you sooner or later it will dissipate, I guarantee it. You'll get your dana back if it doesn't. Sooner or later, it might be later, but sooner or later it'll pass. And it's very empowering, very encouraging, and very instructing, very very strength producing, to have waited it out. And sometimes it can feel like you're in the rodeo, even if you're sitting still, to do that. And I've known people who've been addicts who've done that practice of waiting things out and felt like it was like a revelation. I can do it. I don't have to give in to these impulses. So I recommend that you find an impulse. And I mean, don't go make one up, but find a good one. And if the next day or later in the day, even better one arises, then do it again. And then if you, because even better one arises later, even strong ones, oh, I guess I chose the wrong one. And then do that one. And then explore patience, explore endurance, explore perseverance, explore forgiveness, explore holding the mind still. And if the mind is still, the body will be still. Because to hold the mind still is not to give in to those impulses. I'm very fond of the idea that patience as a parami is sandwiched between vigor, energy, and truth, which is next month. It's after having developed a capacity for engagement, for practice, for energy and practice, that this list talks about patience. So patience is not a giving up of effort. In a sense, it's perfecting the effort. And then patience is followed by truth, honesty. And in some way or other, truthfulness is said to perfect patience. I'm not sure how that is, but maybe I'll know, figure it out, or discover between now and then, next month. So, what do you think of that? And I hope it's been inspiring a little bit. And does anyone want to say anything? We have a couple of minutes before the end. Right over there. Please use the mic.
It's a good topic for me because last weekend, my friend had asked me to come over to his house in the East Bay and help him with a construction project with a few other friends, and I'm on public transportation, so it can take 3 hours for me to get over there, and I was already running late, and I was getting to the BART station, and there are a few people in front of me, and there was a train already there, and I was like, oh, I get this train, I might get there in half an hour, and there are just three people in front of me getting the ticket, and I'm sitting there, and it's taking longer and longer and longer. I think the train's just waiting for me right there, and it finally gets to the one person right before me, and I can tell they really don't know how to use the machine, and I'm just going crazy, sitting there going, come on, come on, come on, and of course the train, leaves right then, and I'm like, I'm getting so angry, and I'm focusing all my frustration on this person, like, oh my God, why did it have to be you standing there? And of course I make it. It's fine. It doesn't matter. I'm a little late. These are my friends. They're lazy. They don't care. I'm hearing you say this, and it occurred to me. I missed out on an opportunity. I should have helped this person. They've probably not from around here. They don't know how to use this machine, and I've been using it all my life. I could have helped this person get their ticket and get to where they're going, and they're probably frustrated too. And it's if I had just been a little more patient, not getting caught up in my rush to go nowhere.
So the the idea that patience follows the perfection of effort. in my mind, associated with the idea that we engage in life the best we can, with the best effort we can, without having too much at stake. So, you know, we try to do the best job we can, but we don't invest it with our ego, and, you know, we don't have, nothing's at stake in our hearts in doing it. But we do it as best we can, and then it is what it is, and if it doesn't work out, then we haven't sacrificed the quality of our hearts. So I hope that all of you are I hope all of you cherish your hearts, the good quality of your heart, the good qualities there. And if you don't know that they're there, then maybe you could take my word for it. And I'll tell you, it is there. Good qualities are in every heart. And it's something to be safeguarded, taken care of, and it's something to be discovered and developed. May the goodness of your heart benefit others. Thank you.